Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
Hey, Souther. How you doing, bud?
I'm well.
Excellent. That's good to hear.
Do I sound okay? Dave, do I sound okay?
No, you sound normal.
You sound magnificent.
Oh, okay. It's a new board.
Yeah, it's a new board, so yeah there's some quirks.
Sounds different in my
headset. We're working out the quirks, but
did we get enough donations through our shows to get a new board?
No, we're just in debt.
We're just in debt again.
It was a smash and grab situation.
All right, well, either way, we're still working.
We swung by the Best Buy after hours.
Yeah. It was a little Long Island midnight run.
Yeah.
Say, how you been, man? What's going on?
I've been well. It's been a good week.
Cool.
I've been holed up in my apartment writing.
On your phone?
On my phone.
You're going to write the whole fucking book on your phone.
Indeed, sir.
That's amazing.
That's my goal.
Nice.
I turned in just over 2,600 words yesterday. Felt good.
Wow.
Yeah, it's... Young David Tatasciore, the Foley artist, the budding Foley artist. Yeah. I feel like the week has blinked by because I did just hole up kind of the whole time and work on the book. You know, in addition to working at the bar four nights, which, you know, that's I always forget for me to work four nights at Amore Margo. That's a 50-hour commitment.
Yeah.
Right. So like that chews up your week without really noticing.
Oh, for sure.
And then the remaining 3 days, I just worked on the book. Anyway, what have you been up to this week?
I was in New Mexico.
Yeah, for your mom's celebration. Not her birthday, but the celebration, right?
Her 60th, yeah.
Right, her birthday was earlier.
It was last month, yeah. But we went out this month. And, yeah, actually, it's really cool. I love going out there. And, yeah, man, got to check out some of the, like, budding cocktail bars.
Sure.
That are out there. I mean, I got to go to the old school places I like to go to when I'm out there, but, I kind of want to give a quick shout out to Angela and the team at Secreto in Santa Fe, the team at Tonic, really cool little jazz cocktail bar there.
Yeah, I was following your Instagram stories. Lots of good looking boomerangs.
Lots of cheersing. Boomerangs.
Yeah, you've really come into your own in the boomerang world.
Hey man, it's I'm trying to stay young, man.
Hey, you're doing great.
There's also the Cumbre Brewing Company out of Albuquerque. Our buddy, a longtime listener of the show, hit me up, and I unfortunately couldn't make it over there, but wanted to say hey.
You still got to drink some of his beers, though.
I had some of his beers. All right. Very good. Anyway, yeah, so like it was really cool. It was a really cool trip. Lots of green chili, which I'm sure you'd really appreciate.
I would.
And, good times, man. Really great vibes. It's, you know, like, vibes. Every time I travel, which has been a lot lately, but it's just so cool to see what people are doing in different markets. Like, you know, like, especially, like regional ingredients, you know. Like, I remember going to, like, Peche in Austin, Texas, like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was cool. Like, there was also another place, I don't even know if it's around anymore. I think it was called, I think it's just called like Hometown, something like that. I'm going to have to check myself on that. Townhouse. Mm-hmm. And they were doing like this red chili cola that made in house. And it's just like cool using like the regional stuff, like agave and chilies and stuff like that. So there's a lot of green and red chili, you know, cocktails in New Mexico. And it's great. Yeah. It had this really awesome last word variation with like green chili in it, chartreuse.
Ooh, that sounds great.
Yeah. It was
New really Mexican good. Green chili and chartreuse.
Yeah.
So, spicy sweet.
Yeah. It was awesome. And that was at Secreto. Mm. But anyway, so...
Idea for my book.
There you go, yeah.
Must do it.
Yeah, it's just cool, like, seeing, like, you know, it's a big, beautiful world out there, but it's also kind of small, you know?
Yeah, like, it has its insular pockets, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of insular pockets,
yeah,
our guest on the show today wrote a book about the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shanna Farrell, author of Bay Area Cocktails, is joining us in the studio today.
Welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you.
Pleasure's all ours.
So I get people to send me their bio or at least a little chunk of something to give me some heads up if I don't have a good personal connection with them when they're coming on the show. And your bio, the first thing it states was the most fascinating part to me. You're an oral historian?
I am, yeah. I work at UC Berkeley in the Oral History Center. So I do long-form life history interviews. Everything is recorded, transcribed, archived, and I work on a lot of things, but I specialize in cocktail history. So interviewing distillers, bar owners, bartenders, writers, historians. Cool.
How do I get a job like that?
Yeah.
I kind of have to carve it out.
Oh, wait, this is a job like that. This is a job like that.
But you don't get paid.
Right. Okay. We're going to work on that. That's fascinating. How does one go about getting into that line?
So my background is in music production. I went to undergrad for that. And so the sound and the recording and the engineering was always kind of the foundation for it. And then I went to grad school doing informational interviews. I was at NYU doing interdisciplinary stuff. I called it environmental anthropology. I made that up. And then
the best jobs are always the ones you make up.
It's vibes. True. Yeah. I make up a lot of my jobs. And then I went to Columbia and did their oral history program. So from there, I moved to Berkeley.
Yeah. Did their program, meaning you went to their...
You
attended.
So
sorry.
I did. I got my master's in oral history. There's a program up in Columbia that specializes in it. So I learned how to do the whole methodology, and I was doing more environmental stuff, but I was doing a history of the Hudson River, and I wanted to interview a distiller because I'd been bartending. So I was like, well, this would be an interesting part of the project. So I ended up interviewing Ralph Arenzo from Tulletown.
Cool.
Right.
Yeah.
Tulletown.
Yeah. Tulletown. Yeah.
Yeah. Ralph and Gable.
That's yeah. Gable. Part yep.
Of yeah. Yep.
Okay. So you're doing an oral history of the area, and then you decide to fold in distilling into that, and then that suddenly becomes the rabbit hole that is then now your entire focus.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was bartending. I always liked the spirit production, and that there was a narrative on the bottles, and I was like, this is really interesting. Why don't I talk to the people who make this stuff?
Where does all that archived information end up? Is it somewhere that I could go and access and listen to? And
yeah, there's a lot of my transcripts that I've done through Berkeley are available online. So anywhere in the world, you can just search. You can search my name, UC Berkeley, and then the search engine will come up.
Shanna Farrell, UC Berkeley.
And then all the interviews that I've done will come up, including one with Dave Wondrich. That's up there.
Cool.
Yeah. And they're all audio.
We record on video. When I do them on my own, I do just audio. So for the book, I did think this on the side, and it's all audio.
Cool.
Outstanding. Have you parlayed this into like a podcast?
Yeah, I'm working on one right now.
I'm trying to figure out business angles for you.
Yeah, it's like you're going to put us out of business.
I'm working on a podcast now called The Prefix, and it's about the intersection of food and drink, because I feel like in the culinary world, cocktails or drinks kind of get the second stage. They're not really the bell of the ball. So I wanted to put them in conversation with each other. So it's like the thematic intersection between food and drink.
Yeah, that's totally interesting to me as a former chef. And also, you're right. Cocktails and drinks are not the bell of the ball, though they are the workhorse of revenue.
It's true.
Which they seems are the super profit odd. Centers. Which seems super odd to me that more fine dining establishments don't pay as much attention to cocktails.
Yeah.
When it's where the money's at.
Yeah, you could do a little devil's advocacy here, though. I mean, I wouldn't say you're like 100% right across the board.
No, of course not. Nothing's 100%.
Obviously, things have changed a lot over the past 10 years.
Incredible.
But yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I'd say still it's generally not the focus. You know, I can go eat at La Bernadette, which I have only done twice in my life, and it's amazing, and I love the food, and I love Eric Raparan. They just got a third Michelin star, which is incredible. And, you know, you could get a decent Manhattan, and their house cocktail list is pretty unremarkable.
So you're saying they're never going to be on the show?
No, let's get them on the show and talk about this.
Yeah, totally.
There's a disconnect between, like, what is on the back bar versus what's coming out of kitchens, I think. So I don't know. I kind of subscribe to the Thad Vogler school of thought, where spirits are agricultural products. And so, like,
join you, Damon.
If you're not going to put additives in your food, don't carry stuff with high fructose corn syrup in it. I don't know.
Sure.
To me, it seems
fair enough.
It seems pretty obvious. Yeah. Well, I recall very much, you know, my first experiences behind the bar after leaving the kitchen. It seemed very shocking to me that people were extremely interested. You know, at bars I worked at back in those days, I worked at chef-driven restaurants, and I was behind the bar because I felt more comfortable in those environments. But it seemed very odd to me that a guest who was maybe dining at the bar would ask me every question about every item on the menu. Is the beef free range? Are the hen's eggs local? All the thing? And then they'd go, yeah, I'll have a mojito. And there's 4 feet of snow on the ground, and I'm thinking to myself, do you know where this mint came from? Like, it wasn't from around here. You know, like...
I mean, when you put it that way, I get what both of you are saying.
But I also totally understand that food is more, you know, driven by necessity, and drink is more driven by frivolity and you know, celebration. And you say to yourself, you know, I want to treat myself. I want a mojito in the middle of winter. I get it. But I still thought that it was odd that the questions were never going to arise. They would never. No one's ever really asking me questions back then. Certainly, you're right, David. Like, it's come around some.
Yeah. Like, and then you order a Captain and Coke.
Is this Total Town? Is it from nearby? Like, they'll ask questions like that now. But in the past, there's no questions like that whatsoever.
Well, that yeah.
And I mean, remember you worked behind,
of course, yeah,
the bar, like, Prime Meats. And
no, I'm old as fuck. I know, but I don't know. It's. I just, like, I've seen, like, all sides of it to where, like, I'm not, that's not me, like, saying, like, I know everything, because I don't, and I'm glad that I don't know everything, because I love learning.
I'm super glad you don't know everything.
But, like, you know, I've worked in places where it's, like, and I've been to places where, like, say, major food group, where, like, Thomas Wah is making these crazy fucking cocktails, and the presentation and the production is just insane. And then, like, places like, well, very recently, you know, like the Aviary is in New York City now, and just the production and, like, the pomp and circumstance, like the show of the cocktail is every bit as much considered as the plates that are coming out.
Yeah, it's starting to have its, I feel like this is maybe the third wave of the cocktail revolution.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
you know.
Like, that's fair.
We had the wave of the bartenders know all. Then we have the wave of the consumer knows plenty now. And now we're having the wave of it's connected to the kitchen.
Yeah, for sure.
And that at least in that way, in the pomp and circumstance way.
It's interesting. Yeah, I feel
it's very much different, like, on the coasts.
Yes.
Which, you know, I mean, like, what we're talking about today, like, what we should get into with get the into book, it. Bay Area Cocktails, it is a very, like, the West Coast thing is, like, very, as we know, like, East Coast, we're like, fuck it, boozy, bitter, stirred, forget it. Well, of course, you know that, because I'm wearing Margo, that's all you do. But then, of course, there's a lot of, like, herb and fresh produce-driven cocktails. That's more, like, the iconic, like, West Coast style.
Sure.
So how does that play into this book?
Yeah, so actually talking about the culinary conversation, the revival really grew out of the culinary world. It wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Sure.
There's a, you know, the Alice Waters school of thought and using fresh seasonal ingredients. And so the book kind of starts off with that a little bit, and then how that affected distilling, because the first craft distillery since Prohibition opened in 1983 in Alameda, California, which is St. George Spirits, just had their 35th anniversary.
Yeah.
And then a year later, two other craft distilleries opened in the North Bay area, so like near Napa, Sonoma, that area. Right. And so that kind of, I think, starts to drive things forward.
When did Charbet start making spirits?
That was in 84. Their Charbet and Germain Roban opened a year after St. George.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I knew they'd been around for a while.
Okay. Which is still incredible. Such a fertile area full of plenty of things that could be distilled. And 50 years after Prohibition was the first distiller. That's crazy.
It's crazy. The distillery was also opened by a former judge. So Jörg Rupp founded it, and he was a judge in Germany. So he had a lot of, like, legal knowledge that helped him set up the distillery. And he also helped open and gave guidance to a lot of other distillers around the country that kind of helped the craft distilling thing happen. Yeah. So,
cool. I mean, it's a leader and a pioneer who understands that a high tide raises all boats. You know, if you can set yourself up and then set other people up for success as well, you're only going to raise.
Like Ralph Renzo did.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So that's very cool. The whole, I'm very fascinated by this whole oral history thing. And then parlaying that into what is potentially going to be some kind of crazy podcast that's going to dominate Heritage Radio. Are you listening? Maybe you should, maybe you should pick this thing up. And then how then did you then translate that towards this book? How did you... Is this your first book?
My first book, yeah.
Of any kind?
Of any kind, yeah. I had actually written an article for Punch a few years ago that kind of helped launch my writing career a little bit, and that was about being a woman who writes whiskey. And that actually helped launch the project as well because they put me in touch with Dave Wondrich and Dale DeGroff, and so they, through conversations with them, kind of gave me some topics to think about, people to talk to. And then I started writing for some smaller, more local, like Edible East Bay, and that I started like kind of honing in on different topics, and then that's from there kind of was the blueprint for the book. But yeah, so all the interviews were long form. I think I interviewed over 30 people for the book. Some of them were shorter. I call them more informational interviews, like a half an hour, but some of them ended up being like anywhere from 4 to 6 hours with one person.
I'm betting Wondrich was a 6 hours.
Yeah.
He was definitely one of the longer
well,
ones.
Well, I mean, you can ask him so many questions, and just on the side, he's got so much to say.
Yeah, and we actually...
That guy likes to talk.
With him, we talked a lot about his background in music and
yeah,
how he got a start in writing and everything.
That was my first conversation with him. We were... Speaking of women and whiskey, I worked at Linnell's LTD back in the day, and when he... was launching Imbibe, we made some Blue Blazers and some Tom and Jerry's in the store, and most of the time we just talked about our old school punk rock days.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It was really cool.
We're right here at the midpoint. I want to take a break, but I do want to point out it's cool that we brought up Dave and you brought up Imbibe in particular. Did you know that just the other day was the 10-year anniversary of Imbibe?
Yeah.
So shout out to Dave Wondrich for sparking a lot of fires that are still burning. That's really amazing. Thanks for everything, Dave. So, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come back with Shanna Farrell and talk more about, we're going to get into the meat of the book, Bay Area Cocktails.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Shanna, talking about your book, Bay Area Cocktails. You know what? Okay, before the break, you mentioned something about being a female writing about whiskey for Punch. I love that. You know Heather Green? She wrote the book,
yeah.
Whiskey Distilled. She's been on the show before. Yep. And also, Talia Bioki from Punch. I still think it's a remarkable thing that we have so many outlets for information about the industry and about spirits and cocktails and everything. I'm like, you know what? I find it funny though to mention that like a female doing the whiskey writing thing. Cause I'm like, when I think about all my favorite writers, they're all females. So I'm just like,
yeah,
we're not really like holding up our end of the bargain.
Listen, hey, We're doing our best. I think it's also it's scientifically proven that females have a better sense of olfactory sense, so their smell is heightened, which aroma is 90% of flavor. It all makes sense to me.
Totally. Well, you also we were talking a little bit before the show. You were talking about your background in being an oral historian and everything. This must be weird for you being interviewed, right? Because you're normally the one interviewing people.
It's super weird. This doesn't feel natural.
Are we doing well? Are we good at it?
You're doing great, yeah.
You can tell us we suck.
I think we're just conversationalists.
It's great.
We're not getting a raise. We're not getting a paid emotion. We're just going to stay steady at $0 no matter what you say.
It's also radio. When I interview, I like sit back and don't talk very much. I just ask questions.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm glad that you're here with us today doing this. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. Let's talk about this book. As far as the Bay Area cocktail history goes, where would you kind of like tie back the origin? I know there's certain things that are very iconic for San Francisco. Say like Pisco is a huge, like, did you know that?
I did actually.
Pisco was like a huge thing. It came through San Francisco into the United States.
Yeah, because San Francisco used to be a port town.
Right.
So that would come through and there was a surplus all the time.
Obviously, you've got like things like Fernet Branca.
Yeah.
Huge.
Wait, what? What's that?
I don't know. Let's listen to Shannon.
Oh, is that the cracking sound of a Fernet Branca bottle?
A fresh Fernet bottle.
Wow. It's a little bitty baby.
So it's actually interesting. I kind of cite the ground zero for the Bay Area cocktail revival at the Townhouse in Emeryville. Started with this guy, Paul Harrington, mm-hmm. who wrote a book, but he had been, I don't know, going to flea markets and finding old cocktail books before they, you know, when they were like 50 cents and not $500.
Sure.
And so he was doing, this was also before a time where there were cocktail menus, restaurants didn't have cocktail menus. So he was doing the bespoke thing and he had all this fresh knowledge that he'd be really excited to share with people. He ends up moving. He's at the Townhouse for a while. He was going to UC Berkeley. He ends up moving to Enrico's in North Beach. And he had just bought this book, a Cuban cookbook, and in the back there was a section on rum drinks. So he was really into the Hemingway Daiquiri and the mojito. Two writers come and sit in front of his bar at Enrico's, and they're like, hey, can you make us a nice drink for the summer? And so a mojito is made, and that they ended up writing about it. Kicks off the mojito craze, which lived on for many years in North Beach. That was Paul Harrington.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then the writer, so people would come in with the newspaper and order off the paper. And he was like, this is weird. This is kind of antithetical. I like having that the intimacy of that interaction with my guests.
Oh, wow.
So he didn't. And then it was also some uncollegial people there. So he ended up going back to the townhouse. People followed him there, including this guy, Gary Wolf, who I think I may be messing this up. I have to fact check myself. But a couple writers followed him back. Wired magazine is starting their blog called Hot Wire. There's a woman, Laura Moorhead, who pitches this cocktail column. And Gary was like, yeah, you can do this, but you have to contact Paul Harrington. So Paul becomes one of the source of information. So we would go into the Hot Wired offices, and then on like Thursdays and Fridays, make cocktails. There'd be like 12 researchers. That's how the Alchemist blog started. And then he started writing. Laura kind of pushed him to start writing. And then, he came out with one of the first cocktail books since Prohibition, during the revival. And then decided that he really wanted to be an architect. So he ended up leaving the industry when he was 30, moves back up to his home state of Washington, becomes an architect. And that's why we don't really hear from him very much anymore. It's because he left the industry. But that book ends up on the shelf of all the bars around town. So when I was doing all these oral history interviews, people kept mentioning Paul Harrington. They were like, this is the guy I interviewed Jeff Morgenthaler, and he pulls Paul's book from the shelf and starts reading from it. Eric Adkins from The Slant of Door is talking about him because that was the book he learned how to make everything from, like, takes it out of his briefcase, puts it on the table as he's talking about it. I was like, I got to interview this guy. I got to find out. So I kind of cite him as the ground
Genesis,
zero guy.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And yeah. So you went and had a face-to-face interview with him?
I actually interviewed him on the phone. Which I don't recommend, but it was kind of my only option. But yeah, I did a couple hours with him on the phone, and since then I've actually written an article that was pretty cool. People saying that the townhouse was where the revival started, and Twitter started, all the old school cocktail folks started picking up on it, and that was really fun.
It's amazing.
Cool. Yeah. So, just backing up a little bit, So then you would say that the actual like San Francisco like Bay Area, like it started in Emeryville, like in like Oakland, like between Emeryville's between yeah. Oakland and Berkeley, right?
It's that like weird sort of area where Prize Fighter is now, but right. It's an old industrial area.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I gave Souther my Prize Fighter.
The Prize Fighter koozie right here on my beer.
I noticed that when we started. I was like,
yeah.
Yes.
I was just there like 2 weeks ago.
Oh mm-hmm. nice.
Like
yeah.
And I didn't see you guys.
Yeah.
Sorry.
We weren't there.
I didn't make it by Beretta.
Too busy making Pim's cups.
I tried, man. We were in Big Sur. It's getting weird, you
makes
know?
Sense.
But, no, because you think about, like, okay, so is it fair to say, like, San Francisco and the Bay Area are, like, two different things, or do you just call it all the same thing? Because, like,
it's all the same thing.
All,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, because yeah. when I think about, like, iconic, like, San Francisco cocktails, I think I immediately go to the Buena Vista Cafe
yes.
with the Irish coffee. And that shit's been going on for a long ass time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And also a little insider tip here for the outside is you can get roadies of Irish coffees at the Buena Vista Cafe.
Well.
They'll sell you the coffee and the cream and like a to-go coffee cup.
Yeah.
And then they'll sell you a little 50 ml bottle of their Tullamore Dew house blend. And then you could take it to the park.
Yep.
Get out of here.
Yep.
Yeah. It's awesome, man.
You always got to leave with one.
Yeah.
DIY.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you think about things like that. You think about, well, obviously, Fernet Branca, like in basically everything and on everything.
Yeah.
But those seem to be more like San Francisco and not Bay Area. And, or sorry, East Bay, rather.
Yeah, okay. I mean, but there is a lot of crossover between the East Bay and San Francisco. It's all Bay Area, but and a lot of these people are in the same community. A lot of people, like one of the owners of Trick Dog, he got to start bartending in the East Bay for gotcha. Years. Yeah, yeah. So it's the same community.
When is someone going to open a fucking bar on Treasure Island?
I have been wanting to know the same thing. Dude. There's a new distillery open there.
Everyone's afraid of radiation. I'm like, you know what? What the fuck? Like, I do way worse things to myself.
That's,
like,
yeah.
I'm about to eat that entire cake over there. Like,
it's also really hard to get people to get to Treasure Island. I did a book
How
event
is
at
it
a distillery.
Hard to do that?
It's people are afraid it's of public right transportation. I don't know. It's,
what?
Yeah, yeah. So it's just like
drive.
A little
get
island that's
with.
In the middle of the bay. And
I'm not
yeah.
saying that that's yeah. something you should do. But, right. but you know, it's awesome.
There's a bus that goes there, but nobody takes it.
It's, but it's yeah. right in the middle. Yeah. It's like, it, and also, come on, man. It's called Treasure Island.
It's exactly. It's called Treasure Island.
Yeah. Dude,
how could anything possibly go wrong
Something's
there?
Something's got to be up there.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I think I've never really spent much time there, but like, that's like the part of the everyone's talking about rent being too high and mortgage being too high in the Bay Area and I'm like, dude, let's go to Treasure Island. We'll be on an island full of treasures.
Yes.
And it's like we're halfway between Oakland and San Francisco. It's perfect.
Yeah, the views are beautiful. One time I was driving across the bridge and my car started to overheat, so I had to pull over on Treasure Island. I was like, there could be worse places to be stuck for
yeah,
a little while.
Totally.
Yeah,
nice.
It's really pretty. Yeah.
So Paul Harrington kind of kicked it all off.
Yeah, sorry. Well, before
That's
we go any
job.
Further, let's yeah. clink these glasses.
Yeah.
We do have some. Thanks for bringing this in. We do have some Fernet Branca in the house.
You like this stuff?
I've heard of it before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Paul Harrington, and then I kind of have like four heroes of the book, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Paul being one of them. Julio Bermejo, because he changes the way that America drinks tequila
yep.
and agave spirits. So he's in there. He's very important. His bar is also when the USBG in San Francisco started, one of the meeting places. So community is really big there. Thad Bogler doing the spirits as an agricultural product, demanding that producers are more transparent. And then Marco Valdo Dionysus. He's super important. He opens Absinthe in 1998. He's the first one to put classic cocktails on menus and actually write what year and what book the cocktails came from.
Yeah. I was just there.
Provenance.
I was there like a couple weeks ago with my friend Amanda Womack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
yeah.
she was at Anchor. Now she's with the Jägermeister.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I'd never been there. But Rob Schwartz.
I don't know him.
Didn't he write the book? The classic cocktail book. He works for Southern now, but
I don't know.
Anyway,
what book?
I'm just dropped something. I'm not sure if I could pick it up. He wrote a book.
I like when you talk slow.
Because you're looking at it right now.
Yeah. He wrote a book. Well, talk about, while he's Googling, talk about Julio.
It's called The Art of the Bar.
Oh, The Art, of the Bar. Yeah.
Jeff Hollinger
and Rob. Jeff Hollinger, yes. And Jeff Hollinger was absent for a long time. Yeah, Julio is a really amazing man. Like, one of the most hospitable people. He makes Tommy's feel like both a neighborhood bar and, I mean, he's winning all these awards for his tequila selection. You go in and he remembers everybody's name without fail, always. And that's, I mean, that's just such a welcoming thing. But he'll also, when he was bringing back tequila from Mexico, 100% blue agave tequila, people would be really afraid to try it, so he used the margarita as like this gateway because people were comfortable with margarita.
This was in the 90s, right?
This was in the 90s, and yeah.
Like during the drought and everything.
Right, exactly.
So it was even more precious.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And he'll like make you a flight so you can get the different expressions. And he's done it for us before, and it's, you can...
Flight of margaritas.
Flight of margaritas with different tequilas, and you can really taste the difference there.
Sure.
And so that was the gateway, and that's also, I think, why the Tommy's margaritas become so iconic. Sure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, those are the two things he's certainly known the most for. The Tommy's margarita and hospitality.
Yeah.
Like, he's that. I think it's interesting that tertiarily he's kind of known, I think, as the guy who brought tequila again into the country in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Coming through San Francisco and filtering his way across the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And he also started this educational program where you can become a doctor of tequila, so you have to taste through a certain number of tequilas. And then it's part of how like community grows at the bars, because you can sit down and be tasting through these tequilas and then he'll give you a test, but then you meet other people who are doing the same thing.
That's cool.
And once you become a doctor, you
doctor
go to
Doctor of Tequila.
Yeah, you become a doctor of tequila, and then you go, once you're a doctor, you go to Mexico with Julio.
What?
Yeah. And I've actually,
what are we doing here?
I've gone to Mexico with him before. it's fun. Yeah, I went to Mexico with him and a couple newly minted doctors and got to tour around some distilleries.
Are you saying you're a doctor of tequila?
I am not, no. Uh-oh. But I got to go. Yeah.
Because you're the press.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. That's kind of similar to what they do at, was it Rum Club? They have the map, this giant map of all the rums that they have, and you have to drink a shot of all of them before you get this like certificate of rumness.
I can think of a few places with similar things. There was the place that's no longer around anymore, but it was in Park Slope. It's called Pork Slope.
Oh yeah.
And they had this thing where it's like, you know, their thing was American whiskey.
Yeah.
And so like you would get in the book, and it's, when you had like 100 whiskeys, they would put your name on the trophy.
That's right.
Like a brass placard. And Jim Kearns, who doesn't drink anymore, he's on there like 3 times. So he had like 300 shots there. But then there's a place in, it's in L.A. It's actually, it's the oldest tiki bar, the Tonga Hut.
Oh.
They have, like, if you, I guess it's a Beach Bum Berry's book remixed. If you have all 91 drinks in there, they build this, like, they make these awesome, like, personalized plaques for you and you get on the wall.
Yeah.
You know what? So I was going to say this, man. You should probably think about doing something like this for Amore Amargo.
I've been thinking about it, actually, strangely. Because my buddy, the reason I even thought of the thing at the Rum Club is because my buddy Nathan Lehman did it. And your ultimate goal there is that you learn a lot, obviously.
Sure.
You drink through all the rums in the house.
But then you're also part of the thing.
You're part of the thing. And then you get, so similar to what you just said with the sort of trophy or what have you, what they do out there is they give you a coin, not dissimilar to the Fernet coins or whatever. But then when you, every time you come back to the bar and lay down the coin, you get a snackery.
What? Ooh.
So that encourages you to come back because you know your first snackery is on the house, and then you sit there and you drink the rum, and you've had them all, so you know which ones you like the best. And you,
it's smart.
It's very good marketing as well as community building.
Martin Kate does that at Smugglers too. They have the Rum Bustion
right.
Society.
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, yep. And I think when you
Rum Bustion,
you master all of that, you get to go with him to a rum distillery. I don't know. I'm a little bit more fuzzy on that one, but same sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you're not used to getting
the thing where you drink. We can do a thing where you drink through all the amaros, and then once you've succeeded on the thing,
you
take
to
you
to Italy.
I take you down. I take you down in the basement and break your nose. Because it's bitter, baby.
That took a really crazy turn.
All right, or we'll go to Italy. Your thing's good. Your idea is good too.
I'm good cop.
Your idea is good too.
You got BTP in a gimp suit.
Oh, oh no, images.
wait. Okay, so let's. So let's talk about the Fernet Branca San Francisco connection.
Yeah, North Beach.
Yeah, since you brought us a bottle.
Yeah. Secret handshake kind of was the tacit signal if you order one that you're in the industry. Same thing. I mean, I think that's a pretty common thing. But North Beach, historically Italian neighborhood, a lot of Fernet drunk there. There was this like corner in North Beach, Enrico's, Glow, a couple other ones where the bartenders who worked there took cocktails seriously. And that's how the USBG kind of grew out of it. But yeah.
Wait, 15 Romolo was probably an important part of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people talk about that. It's the black hole.
Yeah.
Always we a black hole tonight. Yeah.
But, I call those entry bars. It's me that goes in.
Oh, yep. Cocktail lounge.
There you go.
It's me that goes in. Not sure who it is that comes out. I entered.
So yeah, it's like it was like a crazy phenomenon. The idea of like Fernet Branca becoming the bartender's handshake.
Yeah.
And then it grew and grew and grew. I'm sure Eduardo Branca is super fucking psyched about that. Why would he?
But it's been coin thing.
But it's been going on forever.
Yeah, for a long time.
For a long time.
Yeah, long before I think the cocktail revival.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I lived in San Francisco in the mid '90s, and it was still, early '90s, '93. I went to culinary school out there.
Oh, cool.
CCA.
Yeah.
Valedictorian.
What? Nice.
Yeah.
You never told me that.
Hey, man, come on. I'm humble.
until just right now.
Until just this moment. Well, I've had just enough.
As recently as right now.
Bronca and beer.
You were living there, was the Fernet Bronca thing a thing?
I don't think I was super aware of it, but I certainly remember people drinking it. Because I remember very clearly people drinking a lot of something I don't particularly like, which is ginger beer ginger ale. Because you'd get both.
Oh, yeah.
You'd get a shot in the back.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They always did it back.
And I remember being like, I'm not into that because I don't like that. But I would just drink whatever I drank. Old Overhole, probably. Well, It was definitely what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Old Overbite, we used to call it.
What bars did you used to go to?
I was a student, and I was poor and broke, and I lived in the Tenderloin.
Okay.
And I frequented a place called the Brown Jug, which I believe existed until just a few years ago.
Okay.
The reason that we went in there in the very first place, the very first time we ever went in, my roommate and I, we walked by, and it had no windows. It was on the corner of Gary and I'm never going to remember. But it had no windows, and it had a sign on the door that said, "No phone, no toilet, no change. Just booze." And I was like, oh, this is the place for me. Because even back then, I drank like an old man.
Did you go to the Page? Did you go to 500 Club?
No, I mean, honestly, the place
Kill
I remember, the two places I remember the most are the Brown Jug and a place called the John Bull Cocktail, which was like a longshoreman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was very similar to like Milano's here in New York.
Yeah. I just met a guy in Santa Fe, actually. I'm not going to name names or anything, but he said he met his current wife at the 500 Club in San Francisco, and I'm not saying this to this is a testament to the 500 Club and not to any of their characters, but he's like, yeah, we're getting divorced. I'm like, oh, how long have you been married? He's like, about a year. Like, where'd you guys meet? 500 Club. I'm like, oh shit.
You had a good run.
It's a pretty long marriage for someone you met at the 500 Club. That's
one of those bars that opens at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah, they still have the sign outside that when it's illuminated, they're open at 6 a.m. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think that's, I mean, like, we're talking about some divey stuff now, but like, that's part of the experience in San Francisco. I mean, like,
totally.
Talking about like, even like, the slanted door's been around for quite some time now, too.
Yeah.
And Eric Adkins, you mentioned before.
So like, Thad Vogler started that when they this slanted door, I think this is their third location on the Embarcadero and the ferry building. But when they got their liquor license, Thad Vogler was hired to run the program. So he's the one who started slanted door. He trained Eric Adkins. Yeah.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. So now Eric is the beverage director for the whole group. But
right.
Yeah, that is
cool.
Yeah.
It's cool seeing like the way that like my first experience, in San Francisco, my first time to ever go there was actually going to Beretta. I was guest bartending with Ryan Fitzgerald, who now owns ABV. Mm-hmm. And it was awesome. Like, first of all, it was actually my first paid trip as a bartender, I think. I'm pretty sure it was. And I'd never been to San Francisco before. Got to hang out. Got to run around with Ryan Fitzgerald. You know, did all the things. Go to Zuni Cafe for, like, the roast chicken, a bunch of Humboldt Kumamoto's, and, like, rosé in the, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then he's the one who took me to Buena Vista and, like, all these other places, like, Comstock. And at that time, Trick Dog wasn't open yet. But, like, it's just cool, like, over the last, like, I guess it's been, like, 7 years, 8 years since then, maybe, something like that. But it's just saying, like, it's really cool to see the progression of that city in such a short period of time. It's always been like, we're talking about the history of it, but it's a really exciting city to go to for like food and beverage.
Yeah, there's a lot. And actually one of the chapters in the book is about the proliferation of cocktail bars. So it was like, basically there's a bar in every corner. And I think that kind of starts with Bourbon and Branch. That's one of the first bars without being attached to a restaurant that people are like, oh, this thing works. People want cocktails. They don't need food.
Yeah.
And so that I think changes. It gives food. It gives people like, okay, we can make this happen. And then from there, it's like every week something is opening now.
Right.
It's insane.
Yeah, it's cool. And then, you know, we mentioned before like Leo Leho and like Smuggler's Cove and Whitechapel, like all these like kind of like more thematic places.
Sure.
It's like, I mean, I don't know. To me, like San Francisco is a very big sleepy city. You know, it is. I mean, it's a big city. It's a major city, but it is kind of sleepy at the same time, which is like I find endearing. And to have so many like options for like kind of like thematic bars.
Yeah, it works.
It actually works.
It's a hungry and thirsty town. I'm actually from New York. And so I agree with you. San Francisco feels quiet. But
well, compared to here, especially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely there's people want it there.
Yeah.
And it's also, I think, also has to do with income as well, because tech is right there.
Right.
So people do have a lot of expendable income that they can spend on good food and drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frivolity.
Yeah.
Spend on frivolity. Certain. That's what we do.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary. But it's fun.
Well, so is the 500 Club.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so do you have a piece of the book that you can't not share with us today? Like what piece is the thing that you found the most intriguing or fascinating or
definitely
horrible?
The Paul Harrington thing was a big deal, but also I think the forming of the, I don't know. I mean, I do think that the West Coast has contributed a lot to the revival, the national revival. Thinking about the chronology of things, Absinthe opening in 1998, they don't get the credit that they maybe deserve sometimes. I mean,
for
I think
a spirit
a lot,
that wasn't available until like what, 2006,
right? Exactly. Yeah. So 12. There was a lot of stuff happening then as well. Something else opens in 1999. I'm now forgetting, but that was a big deal. I feel horrible. I'm forgetting it. But yeah, there was just a lot happening here before. There was a lot happening in the Bay Area leading up to like the cocktail boom.
I will say this, like more than anything else on the West Coast, San Francisco was the biggest player as far as the consciousness of ingredients. Because it wasn't really coming from LA because not, at least not back then. But like, I feel like all of them, like wine, spirits, beer, and then food, like it all was coming from
it was
Northern California.
Yeah, and it's funny because living here and then moving there, New York food actually feels a couple years behind. I know that's a
how
bold claim. That makes people really angry, but it feels.
Pour me some more from that.
I can see it. They have a greater access to a wider swath of fresh produce for a longer part of the year.
Exactly.
Here our season is in comparison pretty short.
Yeah.
And the stuff isn't super close by anyway. You're in downtown San Francisco and you're a short drive away from farmland.
Yeah, and there's farmers markets every day of the week.
Right. That's whereas here they're kind of like,
and they got your Pinot.
And they got a nice Pinot for you.
You're also in the dead of winter wearing a flannel shirt, so it's like
your winter is summer.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of the microclimate.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Place is awesome. Let's move there, man.
I know, right? I want to get this.
Why did you leave, Southern?
I want to get this tequila doctorate.
You should.
Good reason to move back. Also, I feel like what you're maybe kind of alluding to, I'm gonna put it in a little package for myself. But like, I feel like what happened over there is more outside the bottle, whereas what we do here sort of began more inside the bottle, right? They had more produce and herbs and fruits and things to put into a cocktail.
Sure.
Whereas we were like, oh. Well,
there's an abundance of it. So, and here, exactly. It's like cold as fuck.
So
and
I right. will say people there do love their brown, bitter, boozy spirits.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't deny that at all. But I think that, you know, frankly, they're probably reaching a broader market, a wider base of guests who are interested in what they're doing because they have, more access to whatever you want to call this, culinary cocktails, where things that aren't in a bottle already are brought into the glass.
Yeah. I mean, it just kind of like has a, well, it is what it is. It's like just a very natural vibe. And
Vibes,
man. I can't think of any other part of the United States that has a similar culinary vibe, except for maybe like Charleston?
Sure.
Something like that.
Yeah,
like,
it's another spot that's got a lot of, again, a longer growing season, more harvestable times, more access to fresh produce.
Yeah, really rich agriculture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's great to have the awareness of what those ingredients
Anson
are.
Anson Mills was founded there. I mean, that's a big part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Shannon, this has been great, fascinating, eye-opening. Definitely want to get a copy of your book. It's available everywhere fine books are sold. Am I right in saying that?
On the West Coast, but Amazon. Yeah.
Cool. Oh,
yeah.
Amazon.
Amazon, yeah.
Amazon to the rescue. Small mom and pop organization. Again. They sell a few books.
Drones.
Yeah. I hope they make it. Plucky little organization. Really great to have you on and talking about some heroes from the past, the not that distant past, that have certainly laid the groundwork for where we are today.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here without them.
Exactly.
Thanks again for coming on the show. We would really love to have you back sometime.
Yeah.
Next time you're in town.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been really fun. I listened to the show for a long time. So.
Oh, thanks
it's
so much.
It's cool to be here.
First time caller.
That's awesome. Maybe you can come back and interview us.
Okay. Ooh, that would be fun.
Yeah, turn the tables. I'm telling you, I've mentioned it more than once in the recent past. It's getting time that I need to interview Damon because he's got so many things going on that people need to hear about.
Yeah.
I got lots of stupid things to say.
Lots of irons in the fire, and yes, lots of stupid things to say. Dude, if I interview you, we will get drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Dave will get drunk too. Okay.
You mean more drunk.
All right. As is usual, I'm going to close out the show with a few things to say.
Right now.
I want to plug myself a little bit. I usually don't do that. Shaker and Spoon is a cool thing. They got these boxes you can get in the mail of everything you need to make three different cocktails, four times each, so 12 cocktails. It includes everything you need except one bottle of booze. They invited me along to be a part of this current box, and I wouldn't even mention it today except for the box is for Fernet Branca.
Oh, hey.
Oh,
and that's what we're drinking. And I got a drink in there called Slippery Slopes where I make a house-made cocoa, and it's a hot drink. It's a cold drink, but it can be also made hot for the wintertime. It's really good. So check out Shaker and Spoon and figure out how to get yourself. It's a subscription thing. I don't have any of the information because I'm just saying that off the top of my head. But coming up shows, we've got, in no particular order, Bernie Lovers is going to come down and talk about whiskey with us. He's bringing a guitar. You're bringing your left-handed guitar, and you guys are going to guitar things.
We're
let's
doing
see.
Guitar things.
You know, guitar things. You're going to guitar things. Giuseppe Gallo has finally confirmed from Italy. He's going to come over and talk about Italicus. Alan Katz is going to be on the show. Bianca Maraglia from Uncouth Vermouth is going to be on the show, and she's got something to unveil. I guess she's going to bring it to us first.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all the upcomings that I can see in the future, except for way out there. We've got Willie Shine's going to be on the show and talk about all things Jägermeister. Arthur Shapiro's coming. Yeah, we got
a lot of it's that time of year, man.
It's great. Yeah. I love it. And the holidays are coming up and all that rigmarole.
Yeah. Anyway. I feel like you're so quirky that during the holidays do you like fast? You don't like actually cook anything or
I'll tell you that Thanksgiving is tough for me. It's my least favorite holiday.
I hear
and that. For about I don't know. There's a solid 10-year run there where I would have I would spend Thanksgiving with my granddad and a turkey. One bottle of Old Granddad, one bottle of Wild Turkey,
yeah.
by myself at my house. But for the past 2 years, I spend Thanksgiving out at Dale DeGroff's house with Dale and Jill.
Oh, right on, yeah.
And a bottle of Old Granddad and a bottle of Wild Turkey.
Speaking of guitars, well,
I'll be doing this Thanksgiving. What about you?
I don't know what I'm going to do on Thanksgiving yet, but it'll probably involve some turkey.
All right.
But I do have a recipe. It's I've run many a pair of suede cowboy boots making this because I always forget to.
Do you make it in the boot?
No. I just I always forget to, like, because I don't cook that often.
Oh.
So I always forget to put like towel or the
oven mitts.
Oven mitts, yeah. So I end up like dropping the tray. But I do a Underberg glazed ham.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, so I'll share that recipe with you.
I would love that.
And if anyone out there wants it, I'll share it with you as well.
You're 2 years ahead of the times.
You, yeah, right. you share that with me. I will make it and take it to the DeGroff's, and we'll talk about it on the show.
Just
after
take
that.
Me to the DeGroff's, man. yeah, but anyway, yeah, holidays coming up. It's time.
It's eating that time and drinking, of
year. Being merry.
Eat, drink, be merry. Yeah, that's all I've got. Take that's us out, Damon. Too.
Yeah, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Shannon, thank you so much for being in the studio today.
Thanks, guys.
My homie's in here.
Pim's cup.
Pim's cups, baby.
Baby.
It's weird to not see you wearing a bandana, but...
it's here.
Ah, cool. Yeah, so that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Tune in to Heritage Radio Network for many other programs like this one. Click on the Beating Heart to donate so we can continue to make this radio show and not get paid. But but keep the lights on and the microphones up. And... until next week, cheers.
Cheers, guys. Thank you so much.
Cheers, babies.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.